Hello, this is Lily Gorin with the New Books Network, the New Books in Political Science podcast. Today I'm joined by fellow podcaster Matt Grossman to talk about his new book, Red State Blues, How the Conservative Revolution Stalled in the States. This book is published in 2019 by Cambridge University Press and goes through a lot of data and some interesting analysis discussing how the Republican takeover of the states perhaps maybe is slightly overstated. But I'm going to let Matt tell us a little bit about that. First, I'd like to invite Matt Grossman to talk a little bit about himself and how he came to this project. Hi, Matt.
Hi, good to be with you.
Thanks for joining me.
I took over a new role at the Institute for Public Policy and Social Research, which is kind of the outreach vehicle between Michigan State University and the state government in Lansing, a few miles away, and did that at a time of increasing Republican control and full Republican control in Michigan. And I wanted to see how the patterns that I had been seeing in Michigan compared with everything else happening nationally. And then the other way I got into this is I had written a lot about the Republican Party having trouble at the national level in translating its campaign rhetoric into actual changes in policymaking. And I wanted to see, people kept saying, well, what about the states? What about Wisconsin, Kansas, et cetera? And so I wanted to see if the same problems developed in the states or if they had found a way around them.
And what you found in terms of the book is that while there's been a lot of success and electoral success, is that the policy outcomes perhaps don't necessarily correspond directly with that electoral success. So I'd love it if you could talk a little bit or unpeel that onion, as it were, a little bit and explain sort of the potential disconnection there.
Right. So Republicans had quite an electoral run. They went from fully controlling three states in 1992 to 26 states before last year's elections. They went from controlling about 40% of the average legislative chamber to about 60% over that same period. So even in a 50-50 national electorate, they made quite a few gains at the state level. But in terms of policy, you don't see the sort of same overall conservative trends. For example, the median state doubled its spending over that same period and increasingly concentrated on education and health. Social issue trends also on areas like gay rights and drug policy also moved leftward. So it's not that they made no changes. I do find that Republican control was associated with fewer liberal policy changes or more conservative ones and a slower rate of growth in government. But they didn't really live up to the rhetoric of the campaign trail about a smaller government that does less. Over this period, the size and scope of government were still growing. And then Go ahead. I was going to say, I also then try to look at the socioeconomic impacts, and I think one of the lessons there is that some of the places that they had been able to make a lot of changes, you're not able to see that reflected in real shifts in the socioeconomic trajectory of the states. So areas like abortion and gun law, where Republicans did make changes, you don't necessarily see, say, the abortion rate changing in Republican states. And areas like union policy, where there was a lot of change, you can see real effects of right to work in, say, decreasing unionization. But it wasn't implemented widely enough to sort of show big differences in Republican-controlled versus Democratic-controlled states' economies.
And so in the book, you go through a lot of these different sort of components of policy, and you sort of talk about a triangulating approach that you're looking at in terms of elections and policy. Can you explain to listeners a bit about what you mean by how you're approaching the sort of analysis?
Yeah, so I started with just the basic trends over time, things that are easy to track beyond the politics, like spending, like counting up liberal and conservative policies, and then trying to model the extent to which changes in partisan control was responsible for those kinds of trends. But I'm suspicious that we tend to count those things that are easiest to count, not necessarily those things that are most important. And so I also wanted to kind of track from a local perspective what the biggest changes that happened in these states or that were debated in these states were. So I looked at history books on each state, and I talked to political reporters in states that had moved towards Republican control. In order to get kind of an on-the-ground perspective of what were the biggest things debated and what were the biggest accomplishments and failures and some at least local explanations for those difficulties. And there were differences. So, you know, some of the findings tend to go together. So, for example, both kinds of analyses show that it's really these size and scope of government changes that are harder for Republicans to make. It is easier to pass these kind of small social issue changes than to redirect the role of government. But some of them were different, especially when it comes to priorities. I think our efforts to kind of count up policies across the state tend to emphasize those that are kind of cookie cutter legislation passed in lots of states. But the local histories tended to emphasize these big fights over the state budget, mostly about whether to tax more and whether to spend more on these huge budget categories of health and education.
And in that regard, did you find differences across the states that had sort of shifted their political directions from Democrats to Republicans?
Yes, I think it's sort of easiest to think about in the South, where you know, there were solidly Democratic states that were nonetheless pretty conservative, both in policy and in their politicians. And so, as you might expect, you know, switching from conservative Democrats to conservative Republicans, in some cases even the same legislator switching from one party to the other, is not going to produce a whole lot of policy change. And I certainly found that. But I added to that a sort of a broader South and a kind of rural state dimension, where it's kind of places that sort of look like the South in their social conservatism and economic liberalism, where you also tended to see a lot of Republican gains, but that were not necessarily associated with real policy shifts. Then you had states that are more swing states, like the Midwest, that moved back and forth between Republican and Democratic control, but still saw shifts toward Republicans over this period. And that's where you saw some bigger potential changes, like in Wisconsin. But one thing that I point out about the Wisconsin story is that Wisconsin started as a very liberal state in economic policy, even though its public was pretty moderate. And so that really gave Republicans an opportunity to shift policy more there towards the right to become closer to the median state in economic policy. So the biggest changes you saw were when you were really shifting from liberals to conservatives and when Republicans had some ability to actually move a state more towards public opinion in its state.
And so as I sit here in Wisconsin, and you note the Wisconsin sort of situation is a little bit of an aberration compared to a number of the other states that you're looking at, I wanted to ask you about, you know, some of these high-profile symbolic efforts also that we see some of the politicians taking here in Wisconsin, obviously Scott Walker and the education unions. But also in a number of states you had, as well as here in Wisconsin, you had, you know, sort of walking out by opposition and fleeing the state. And again, they're not exactly the policy outcomes, but they are sort of symbolic moves. And what place do some of those have in your analysis?
So Wisconsin is certainly an outlier in the extent of change. It's not necessarily an outlier in the issue focus of the change. So labor, for example, was a big area of a movement. It was really the only economic policy area where you saw Republicans, states moving consistently rightward. Education fights were also quite common across the states. In many places, the kind of education opposition was more successful than it was in Wisconsin. There were about six to seven states that had walkouts or large threatened walkouts, and all of those states actually changed policy on education to increase funding for teachers in response, even though it was mostly Republican states. Several of those states actually raised taxes in response to the teacher protests. So that was sort of considerable responsiveness that we didn't see in Wisconsin. I think your point about the tactics getting more severe is certainly well taken and asymmetric. That is, Republicans tend to be more willing to change the rules to benefit themselves, staying in power. The Democrats have a kind of a good government group constituency. And so, for example, in my own state of Michigan, where Democrats have some chance to take over state control, they have already shifted redistricting to a nonpartisan commission with largely support of Democratic interest groups and voters. So that's not really something you see Republican states doing when they have a chance to regain control. So there is a difference in kind of the tactical extremism or the willingness to change the rules to benefit one's own party, but it is increasing on both sides.
And in this respect, I was also curious as I was reading through your book about, and you sort of make these statements in the beginning and the end, sort of framing the analysis, the sort of difference between what's going on at the federal level with regard to sort of a conservative party, in this case, the Republicans in the United States, compared to other conservative parties or other conservative movements in other countries. And also what is then also going on at the state level. Can you talk a little bit about that sort of broader perspective? Because I think it's also really interesting to understand sometimes some of these questions about, quote, success for the sort of campaigned policy advocacy.
Right. So there's a global pattern that government tends to grow in size and scope over time more than contract. And so that is something that conservative parties have to deal with everywhere. But most places in the world, they sort of accept the programs that have already passed and just kind of debate whether we should, how much and whether we should expand government into new roles. The Republican Party is pretty unique in the world in taking a across-the-board conservative perspective and claiming that it's going to actually retract the scope of government, actually decrease the size and scope of government. And so it has given itself a very uphill battle, something that really no party anywhere has achieved in industrialized democracies. So that is, you know, it's not unexpected that that's a project that the Republican Party was unable to achieve, but it is quite dissonant with the campaign rhetoric that the Republican Party advances and what they're actually able to achieve in government. Now, there is also a difference between the research on American state policy versus international policy in timeline. Internationally, left or right parties did have an effect on the size of government, but it was mostly an effect like from the 1930s to the 1970s. So every country expanded its welfare state, for example, but some countries did it by only 5 or 10 percentage points of GDP, and other countries did it by 30 or 40%, getting up to, you know, nearly half the role of the economy, size of the economy. And that was in large part or in part driven by whether the country consistently elected parties on the left or the right. And then since then, there's sort of been less of an effect to left or right governance internationally, because countries have sort of settled on their relative size of government. In the States, it's the kind of opposite timeline. Studies that try to look at the role of parties in driving policymaking or the size of government show very little partisan effect at all until very recently, until you get to the 1980s or afterward, because we had a whole bunch of conservative Democrats and liberal Republicans. And so if you're looking broadly at the effects of Democrats or Republicans, you're just less likely to find them in the American states. So it's a sort of a weird pattern where the parties started governing ideologically and very different in the U.S. states right at the time where internationally parties had less capacity to make change because the size and scope of government were sort of already set. And I think that that is a big part of the story of what happened in the states.
And you also talk about the fact that a lot of the analysis with regard to sort of the impact of policy development and policy changes is not always as clear, in part because we see on the news high profile incidents, as opposed to, as you note, sort of a systematic understanding of what's going on. And so your book takes up trying to sort of, correct some of that. Can you talk a bit more about how, you know, most Americans understand what's going on in the states and what is actually going on in the states?
Sure. So the media focuses on political conflict. Both sides want to sort of sell their view and criticize the other side, and so that's what makes a news story. But there are many things that are big partisan divides. But still, you know, most policies, major and minor, at the federal level and in the states, still pass with bipartisan support. Most major changes are bipartisan trends. We are still seeing, for example, criminal justice. All states moved in a more punitive direction in the 1990s. Nearly all states are now moving in a less punitive direction. We see trends like early childhood education, where that might seem like a Democratic priority, but pretty much all states are now increasing funding for early childhood education. So there still are these bipartisan trends, and you know, they get less attention than the partisan fights. The other thing I'd point out is just the partisan fights are more likely to be unresolved. So if you're looking at, you know, actual policy change and its actual effects on the socioeconomic trajectory of the states, you see a lot of partisan fights that don't get resolved and so aren't associated with real policy change. So when states have divided government, for example, like Michigan and Wisconsin do now, you are likely to see debates where it looks like a lot is at stake. But if one side doesn't really win altogether, then you may not actually see those stakes materialize. As we speak, Michigan just wrapped up a year of budget debates, only to conclude basically to continue status quo policy and make no major changes, and that is sort of a norm in the states. One other just indicator I'd bring up of this is that we have a lot of tracking, for example, of the American Legislative Exchange Council, which passes model cookie cutter bills across the states from a conservative direction. And it did have major influence. About 1% of the bills passed in state legislatures came from these model bills created by conservative interest groups and legislators. But just as a point of comparison, other scholars have found that about 10% of the bills that pass in state legislatures are those requested by state agencies and pretty much passed as requested. So that's just not going to get a lot of news. I don't think that means that the ALEC bills are unimportant, but it's just a way of kind of putting that in perspective, that a lot of governing is just sort of consensus items that are requested by state agencies or the governor or constituents that just get less attention.
And so in this regard, as you sort of talk about, first, there's this sort of status quo dynamic, but there's also a form of kind of gridlock or stasis, in part because of the sort of fights, I guess. You know, I'm sitting here in Wisconsin, you're in Michigan, got a Democratic governor and a legislature that's controlled by the Republicans. And so the question is, what's gonna happen at the end of the year? You said Michigan, pretty much, here we go again. And so is that the case across the states, or is it just that you and I are sitting in two states where we're a little bit weird?
Well, it's also just occurred in North Carolina, where there was a big fight over Medicaid expansion that didn't materialize, a big fight over teacher salaries that's being postponed until next year, despite a lot of vitriol and even the Republicans trying to pass a veto override while the Democrats were away and told there was no votes. So even when these extreme tactics are used, often the result ends up being not much change. And when there are changes, you know, big changes, they're sometimes reversed, like in Kansas, where there was big policy change, but it, you know, was not, it didn't sustain itself in the end, because even Republican politicians were kind of unwilling to stick with it once they saw the results on the ground. Unlike at the federal level, if you cut taxes in the states, people are going to feel it, because education and health funding and transportation, these kind of big budget categories, are going to be cut as a result. And people notice that, and there's a backlash.
And I wanted to ask you again, also, you sort of mentioned this in one of your most recent responses, but you talk about in the book that where there is significant change at the state level, it's often bipartisan. And you note some of the changes, the shifts that were in the 90s with regard to criminal justice, and then again, a sort of response to that now. Can you talk a little bit about how that has been shaking out in context of the Republican gains across the state houses?
Yeah, so one area we could talk about as a Republican success story is the expansion of what they would call educational choice, charter schools and vouchers. And this is sort of a good example of a real conservative policy shift in the states, but one that was quite bipartisan. It sort of started more in Democratic states, but over time became more affiliated with Republican states. So by the time you get to the end of the period, it's a more Republican-oriented policy. But most of the policy changes actually happened in the wake of President Obama's Race to the Top grant initiative. So we have what in some ways is the biggest success of the conservative revolution in the states, moving education policy towards more charters and choice. And if you kind of look at the dynamics of that, it mostly was a response to the federal government under a Democratic president, providing a competitive grant program to change your policies in that direction. So it was a success, but it required a lot of Democratic help. Similarly, criminal justice reform really could be kind of attributed, at least in part, to a real conservative move. That is, it was core institutions like the Koch Brothers Network, the Federalist Society, the American Legislative Exchange Council, these sort of, you know, big conservative actors that switched their position on criminal justice and achieved policy changes in states like Texas, Oklahoma, Georgia, and eventually at the federal level under the Trump administration. So, you know, you could say, you know, great conservative victory. On the other hand, it's a move toward the traditional liberal view on those policy issues. And it's just so odd in the context of the Trump administration to say, you know, the big victory is moving the country toward, you know, less punitive policies on criminal justice. It's the truth, but it just seems harder to kind of credit that to the conservative resurgence.
And so I wanted to ask you, given that the, you know, sort of some of these examples of school choice or the criminal justice reforms as successes, what what, and your book sort of goes through some of these questions. What are some of the real, quote, failures or non-accomplishments of this sort of red state revolution?
Well, I think the biggest is just the size of government. You know, the government spending doubled. It's concentrated in Democratic areas. When cuts were made, they were often reversed quite quickly. They often were associated with big constituent pressure and protests. And so, you know, it's just not very easy to cut spending or even kind of slow the growth of spending below the rate of economic growth in a state. And when states get money, you know, through things like the tobacco settlement or the BP oil spill, they tend to spend it. It tends not to be reflected in tax cuts instead. So I think that is sort of the big failure. And then I think the other is the inability to kind of move the underlying trajectory of states with the policies that they have passed. So, you know, abortion is an area where every red state passed lots of policies to try to lead to more restrictions. And for that to be a supremely successful policy trajectory and to not actually change the abortion rate in red states is just to sort of say that, you know, some of these underlying social indicators are not as easy to shift with policy as we sometimes think.
And I mean, I certainly understand with regard to abortion rate shifts that it does not necessarily appear to be a sort of conservative victory. But if some of these laws are successful in overturning Roe versus Wade, would then that be considered in your analysis to be a success?
Yeah, so it would be a federal success that would lead to a lot of state change. And that is a good point, that a lot of this is just about the constraints of the federal government, right? The you know, abortion and gun laws can change in every state, but we still have some pretty strict barriers on how far states can go in those areas. There are also differences in federal incentives and opportunities. So we haven't talked yet about the Medicaid expansion.
Right.
One of the huge, you know, in some ways, to conservative successes in the states, in that 14 states still have an expanded Medicaid, all due to Republican opposition. On the other hand, 36 states doubled the size of their largest program in response to an offer, a good offer, but an offer from the Obama administration during the height of Republican control in the states, and often with the support of Republican governors. So it is both a big conservative victory and one that sort of shows the limits. You can stop the growth of government maybe for a while in some areas, but it's hard to turn down free money from the federal government.
And I wanted to just ask you one final question about sort of projecting forward some of the discussions in the book with regard to sort of limiting the sort of liberal or democratic tendencies. And my students are always asking me the conundrum of marijuana policy in the United States. And you've seen sort of interesting areas where this policy is also connected to criminal justice reform in the states. Can you talk a little bit about what you see moving forward in terms of this policy area?
Well, my favorite example of sort of the oddities of liberalism and conservatism in the U.S. states is that policy has both been moving more punitive on tobacco and less punitive on marijuana over the same period by the same party, the Democrats, and by the same near same coalition of interest groups on the left. So you kind of have this you know, and I do have, I have to deal with this in my analysis because, you know, by some definitions, reducing regulation on marijuana should be viewed as a conservative policy. And so in some of my analyses, I do it that way. And in some, I associate it as a liberal policy, as we would conventionally. And, you know, it doesn't change the results that much, but it is worth thinking through is sort of how does something become, you know, affiliated with the liberal or conservative side in American politics. But drug policy overall is just emblematic of the fact that liberal trends in social issues continue in the U.S., even if it might seem like there's a standstill. Opinions on social issues are moving leftward, and policy is moving leftward as well.
And so, given the expanse of your analysis here, which is great, this is really fascinating to sort of dive into the states and various policy areas. What is it that you're working on now to follow up on this?
I'm actually moving next to a broader analysis of social science and the increases in data availability and methodological sophistication and what we are able to say and not say as social sciences as social scientists in with our increasing tool availability. So moving in a slightly different direction, but obviously I'm following up on the role of the Republican Party in government as well.
Oh, okay. Sounds really fascinating. Will you come back on the New Books podcast and talk to me about it?
Of course.
And we'll make it your, I think, what, sixth visit to the New Books Network?
I think we're on number four. So come soon.
Sorry. I feel like, you know, I'm Jon Stewart or Saturday Night Live and you get a prize after number five or something.
I should.
So I wanted to thank Matt Grossman for being with me today to talk about Red State Blues, how the conservative revolution stalled in the States. And this is from Cambridge University Press in 2019. I assume one can get a copy of this book at the Cambridge University Press website. Any brick and mortar stores you want to give a shout out to?
Should be available, you know, online or in stores. So,
okay. Thanks for joining me today, Matt.
Thank you.